Hi, everybody. I'm Gary. I'm an alcoholic. They say in up in Akron, they say, welcome home. And in many regards, I want to welcome you home. This is my home. My home group is right up the street. It's off of Claremont. It's known as NABA, which is the Northeast Atlanta Benevolent Association. And more or less is the place that has inherited the original spirit of when Alcoholics Anonymous was founded here on June 12th of 1941. You'll notice in the program that I'm actually Gary. I'm not John. And that's a lesson. If you don't show up in front for a committee meeting, this is what can happen to you. You end up doing things, and my chair, John, is in the back there. He is the chair of Area 16, which is Georgia. I am the co-chair. Also, as part of this presentation, I don't think I would be doing justice to the memory of John D. John D. In 2003. Got a fellow Bill M. Bill was working as a volunteer with a green shirt on. And without John D., we would not be here today. He was our state delegate that initiated our application for to host this conference. And unfortunately, John has gone to the big meeting in the sky. But I do want to say that one person with an idea and some determination can make quite a difference, because after all, what did we see last night? You know, we would have been somewhere, but the fact that we were here is up to really one fellow, John D. And it's also, we have a very lovely archives room down in Macon, about 100 miles from here. And it was John that got that going in 2003. It's about a 600-foot facility. It's carefully air-conditioned, and we have our various memorabilia. And, of course, I don't have to tell you what archives do as far as I'm concerned. That would be somewhat like preaching to the choir. So, you know, you already know that, you know, we monitor our state business and do what we can to maintain the memory of people that have gotten sober over time in Georgia. We also have a book that is We Share, which is the history of various groups that are in Georgia. It also has abbreviated stories of people that were here over time, old-timers. And one of the challenges we do have, and I think this might be a very common challenge to archivists in general, we have reel and reel tapes. And if you know anything about them, how they're recorded in multiple speeds and how they're on different sides of it's really very complicated in terms of how these tapes have been recorded and how essential it is, because these are tapes that won't last forever. We also have, we get cassettes, and what we're trying to do is make sure that in our particular collection that we keep a focus on what happens of things that are of specific interest to Georgia. One also challenge that Ernest Kurtz, the late Ernest Kurtz, used to say is how he wanted us to do everything that we could to research our local archives. If you're as self-centered as I am as an alcoholic, often when I want to know, what does this have to do with me? All right? And sometimes we've seen lots and lots of pictures of Bill Wilson over time, and what Ernie wanted us to do is make connections so that we can be closer to those pictures. And so in many regards, becoming closer, have those pictures come alive. With that in mind, what I would really like to do is give a concentration on Georgia here and how Georgia fits in to the bigger picture of AA. And actually, our story here starts on January 26th of 1926. You'll see this in Two Motorcycle Hobos, which is Lois's diary. And that's the day that Lois, she was probably driving, we don't know for sure. Bill was probably in the sidecar, and that was the day that they went by Stone Mountain on US 78. And then at that time, I believe only part of Robert E. Lee was there. But I find that sometimes it's nice to take a pigeon and go by old U.S. 78 and go down the route that Bill Wilson did. How we got started here in Atlanta in the first place can be somewhat of a bit of confusion. If you look in Alcoholics Anonymous Comes of Age, Bill thought that Atlanta came actually from an Irwin M., a traveling salesman that came down here from the Cleveland area. However, the confusion is that we did have meetings in the Atlanta area in October of 1940. That was roughly 8 months prior to our actual anniversary. There were meetings here, but the meetings didn't stick. The people that held them were either salesmen or they moved on or unfortunately ended up in jail. So when our roots actually come from a master sergeant by the name of Steve M., he was a pigeon from Washington, D.C. He was John Fitz, the author of Our Southern Friend. He was sponsored by Fitz and came down here he came down here in May of 1941. At that time, there was correspondence going back and forth, and it was Ruth Hawk that said that there was no AA in Atlanta. Our anniversary turns out to be June 12th of 1941, when there were seven people that met in the basement of a house, of an apartment in Buckhead. And that is, again, on June 12th, at that meeting was a fellow by the name of Reverend Sam D. He is more or less George's Bill W. He had been a minister who lost his job due to drunkenness in 1933. He was not a minister for 8 years. It was actually his wife that wrote up to New York and asked for a big book after the Saturday Evening Post article came by. And he received the book in a very grumpy way. If you're interested in that story, there's non-conference-approved literature called The Pulpit and the Bottle, which is you can download as a Kindle, which was written by his children. Actually, I think it was a child and a grandchild that has a detailed history of Sam D. It was then that he was in the Atlanta area, again, after our first meeting. He ends up moving to Rome in 1943. And from there, he actually becomes, whenever someone says first in archives, you better have support for it, because a lot of times people mean well when they make claims for things, but unless you have backup. Let's just say he was a very early circuit speaker and got around all over the place. He got to Houston, got to New York. He was a very close friend of Bill W. He was in Washington, D.C. He was going all over the place. And actually, that was an early problem with anonymity, because, of course, there he was with being a reverend, and reverends use their first and last names. And so when a flyer would come out that Reverend Sam was coming to town, they would use his first and last name, and then someone in New York would see that the anonymity was being violated, and they would write Sam did not allow this to happen. And that got on Sam's nerves over time. And if anything, sometimes before the big book was written, they call that the flying blind time. As far as I'm concerned, in the period after the big book was printed, but then we had no traditions, I will call that the trying, denying, and the crying time, okay? Because of all the, when we look at what we are like without traditions, it's not a pretty picture. And a lot of people don't know any better. And what that does is it brings me to a a person who I find that many people, many knowledgeable people, don't know. And due to anonymity, she was one of us. Her last name is found in the, if you go get a burger at Burger King, all right? But her name was Bobby B. Bobby B. Was the successor to Ruth Hawk. And she was there from April of 1942 until mid-1948. In that period, she often was holding down the fort by herself. Of the correspondence that that we have been able to see that originates in Georgia, goes up to the GSO and comes back, the vast majority of that correspondence is answered by Bobby B. And she does a fabulous job in it, because when you see these, how quickly she was able to respond, and what a great job that she did. She has a lot to do with the formation of the traditions themselves, which were incidentally called 12 Principles to Assure Our Future before they were called traditions. And it is also remarkable to see, as nasty as some of the conversations are that are coming up to her, the way she graciously answers them. And she does so in such a way that she may not like what the person is saying, but she likes the person. She never answers in kind. And I think it is a remarkable experience to be able to see what she did. Getting back to Atlanta for a moment, our first clubhouse was at 57 and a half Broad Street. It was very close to this location. It also, though, prior to the traditions being founded, it was also financed by Coca-Cola interest, an outside interest, excuse me. But that no one knew any better at the time, and Bill W. came, and his first visit to Atlanta was in late July of 1942. Okay, that was just after it opened. Now, we have some research because I believe there will be newspaper articles about this visit, but what we have from in a letter, we have Bill W. gave us two fine talks, which will be long remembered here. We are all talking about his remarks last night, arguing over which part of it we liked best. And to that, Bill responds, "Where shall Lois and I find words to tell you of all we heard and saw and felt while with you? But know that we must have heard the voice of Providence, seen a great miracle, and felt like two very small chips happily afloat on the wave of happy destiny which AA has become. And what shall we say of the thought and care which went into all these splendid arrangements? And how shall we tell you of our appreciation for all those things you did for our comfort and entertainment? It was incomparable." November of 1942, a fellow moved from the Atlanta group down to Savannah, but nothing stuck there until early 1945. We also had what they called a subgroup in Marietta. That's a suburb that's very close to her. We don't know whether or not the meeting really stuck, whether or not we could call it the second meeting in Georgia. On October 4th of 1943, Reverend Sam wrote the GSO saying that he was moving to Rome. And on January 13th of 1944, that's the date, really, of our second meeting. Rome, Georgia, which is about 70 miles north of here, but he was still, Reverend Sam was still determined to keep his membership in the Atlanta group, and such was doing the 70-mile commute rather regularly. Again, in Atlanta, in which we don't have any traditions yet, This is a Tradition 6 experience, and that was in March of 1944. A jewelry company wrote a letter down here to the Atlanta group and said, quote, "It occurred to us that each of the chapters or branches of AA might care to have an incentive in the form of a small button that would tie each other member closer and be a constant reminder of what AA really stands for. The attached rough suggested design has been designed and approved by Bill Wilson." Of course, when the people in Atlanta wrote up to the GSO about this pin, no one in the GSO had heard anything about it at all. But that was, you know, a first attempt at a second example of a second visit by Wilson to Atlanta took place in May of 1944. And when he showed up here, he showed up at 8 a.m. on a Saturday, and they had events for him at 12, 3:30, and 6:30, and they had it in front of doctors and physicians, and they had the schedule planned out for the whole next day. After looking at what they expected from Bill as a result of these visits, it was not very surprising that Bill stopped doing these visits altogether because he couldn't possibly live up to the expectations of us. Okay. And this was in a period in 1944, and research is going on this, and which proves to me archives is something that is unfolding. To me, this is an unfolding detective novel. There's lots of things we don't know. But one of them will be when Bobby B. writes in late 1945 that Bill W. had not been at the New York GSO for 18 months. Okay, that's doctor's orders. And during that period, Bobby was just literally representing AA. We have phrases like, if his health permits, the doctors have advised Bill not to do any traveling or group visiting for some time to come. We don't know what necessarily began this period of depression, which is fairly well documented in 1944, lasts until 55, in his own words. We don't know what the trigger was, but we do now know, and even we do have people that are researching currently whether or not it was possible that Bill, for his own sanity, was going to sever his relationship with AA altogether. That is, again, ongoing, but I'm telling you, there's lots of questions, and the more we get connected, the more questions we have, but the more gratitude we should have for the gifts that we've been given. And what I think archives are really meant to do is provide contrast, depth, but most of all, more than the pictures, these are people in our state, and I hope in your states, that made contributions, real contributions, and in many regards, deserve to be remembered. I'm running short of time, but there's the episode of a magazine north of here that was representing AA. It was out of Chattanooga. We had someone writing for it out of Georgia, representing what AA was supposed to be, according to that person, and misrepresenting AA, demonizing the liquor industry, and not being afraid of being sober in this nasty conversation that goes up to New York. Again, the way that it is handled. Bobby was not a Georgian, but I will tell you this, is that I really want to dedicate this talk to her memory. We don't know what happened to her. We know that, we think anyway, and I've heard, there's relapse, there's nervous breakdown, there's probably a suicide. But the next time you go to a boring traditions meeting, keep this in mind. It took people's lives to write them and to create them. And in every way, we in Alcoholics Anonymous should be as grateful as can be that they exist and for the models they set towards how we could behave. And Bobby B's example deserves to be remembered by us all. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Gary. Thank you, Gary. You know, when I was thinking about this meeting today, I was thinking about what really is archives. It was like when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I thought I knew what Alcoholics Anonymous was all about, but I really had no idea what Alcoholics Anonymous was all about because I thought you were all about not drinking. And what I found here in Alcoholics Anonymous was a life, in a way of life, it was beyond my wildest dreams. And so when I relate that to archives, you know, I'm sitting, and I became archivist for the North Florida area in 2009, and I thought I knew what archives was all about. It was all about the stuff that I see, and it was all about the history. And I loved history, and I loved stuff. And when I found out what archives was really all about, I thought, it doesn't really sound too sexy to me. But what happened for me is my area, they sent me to the National AA Archives Workshop. And in 2010 was my first workshop, and it was held right here in Macon, Georgia. And the thing that impressed me the most about that was probably the thing that first attracted me to Alcoholics Anonymous was the fellowship. It was all of you out there that I see every year at the National Archives Workshop. It was the shared experience that we shared together. And our next speaker, Vicki, I see every year at the National Archives Workshop, and she's a real neat lady, and I can't wait to hear what she says. Help me welcome Vicki.
Yeah! Oh. I love you, Arizona. Hi, everybody. My name is Vicki Jo Bigelow, and I am a grateful alcoholic. Hi. I want to thank the committee for this incredible opportunity and honor. And I had to write things down because I'm really nervous. So I probably won't pay any attention to this, but I want you to know I have stuff written down. Okay. You know, I don't believe for any causes and conditions that I'm up here because of my vast knowledge. I'm up here because God wanted me to learn some more. And every time I've been asked throughout my service history to do a talk or to deliver something, I have to look things up and I get to learn. And I'm grateful for that. The collective vision. Whose? You know, I chose to go with what I know, and it's Arizona. I have a smattering of visions from the National Archives Workshop, and for that I'm truly grateful. It's an incredible entity which has taken us from boxes of stuff in people's trunks, which, how many of you have a box of stuff in your trunk or in a closet? Thank you. Yes, I love your honesty. And you don't know what to do with it. What is our collective vision? I want to do something with this stuff. My sponsor, who's since passed away, Mary D., was the archivist for Arizona. She was also a past delegate. And on Saturdays, she would invite me over to her house, and we would sort. And what that meant was we would take boxes, and we had fun sorting flyers, area stuff, intergroup stuff, random stuff. And as we're sorting, and I'm reading things because, oh, this is so exciting. Look, this happened back in 1978. I know the Sedona Roundup, blah, blah, blah. She'd smack my hand. We're working. Well, one day I picked up a box, opened the lid. The smell of smoke almost knocked me out. And it was all pink folders. And I went, oh, God, this reeks. And she goes, oh, is it pink folders? It's mine. Well, Mary was one of those. Another reason we don't smoke around archives now. God. Anyway, the easy thing to do is to quote a lot of things that Bill said. And, you know, he had said the following in 1957, we're trying to build up extensive records which will be of value to future historians. It is highly important that the factual material be placed in our files in such a way that there can be no substantial distortion. How many of you have had the opportunity to interview long-timers? Isn't that fun? You got to have two. if you get one and you let another one read that history, oh, that son of a gun didn't know what the hell he was talking about. So I have found that it's very helpful to take two long-timers at least together, and they can bounce things off each other. I interviewed a long-timer in our area one time who just, it was not a good day for him, and he couldn't remember the first meeting. He wasn't sure if it was a church or a classroom. But I found when I interviewed him the second time, he had his wife with him who lived through the whole experience with him. She was able to help quite a bit filling in those things he couldn't remember. We want to keep enlarging on the idea for the sake of the history to come. There you have it in a nutshell. Each county district, each sub-district, each intergroup, each area, and even home groups have history. We got a lot of the history, the early beginnings. We have correspondence with the Alcoholic Foundation dating back to 1940 when a Mrs. Gordon O. was writing and say, well, we're in Phoenix and it looks to be fertile territory. We would like a copy of one of those large books. And it goes on from there. There were several letters that went back and forth. They got one back from the Alcoholic Foundation that was encouraging them to be found again because they had lost touch. And Mrs. O writes back, well, we are poor correspondents and cheerfully admit it. I just love it. I've used that line since. I really like it. I am. You know, in the Archives Workbook produced by General Service Office, and it's a lot of it is taken from archivists all over. It says the scope and purpose is to provide a sense of its own past to the fellowship and to create a context for understanding and valuing AA historical milestones and traditions. The main purpose of archives, consistent with AA's primary purpose, is to keep the record straight so that myth does not predominate over fact as to the history of the fellowship. I like dictionary definitions, too, Steve. Thank you. Facts, an interesting theory as far as I'm concerned, especially interviewing long-timers. Fact is a noun, a thing that is indisputably the case, a piece of information used as evidence or as a part of a report or news article. So facts, used as the thing that is indisputably the case of the history, is what archivists should be seeking. Where did the facts come from? If you have long-timers, interview them. We're losing them at an incredible rate. Get them now while you can if you haven't already. Histories in the form of flyers. Intergroup in Arizona started before General Service, so our intergroups have some history. Home group histories, massively important. But there again, another sponsor of mine who's passed away, Ron, we were sitting going through the home group histories one day, and he said, oh, she didn't start that group. That was me and some other guy. And it's like, okay, I give up. You know, per Ron, he started this group. You know, I have to put little caveats on almost everything because people remember things differently. You know, there were five kids in my family, and in any given night, if something happened and you asked each one of us what happened, you'd get five entirely different stories. And I have no idea where the other four siblings were, but that's not what happened, what I saw. My perception. The written word. I've gotten a lot of our history from General Service Office, from the copies of the correspondence. If you haven't gotten that, I'm sure that you can. Old home group histories, no records that I don't have. I've been trying to write the history of the Arizona area, and Arizona is divided up into county districts with the addition of a Spanish district. There are 15 county districts, one Spanish district, and I have received information on six. It's a little tough to get a history of Arizona AA together if you don't have all the information. But we have vast areas. When General Service Office people came for a special regional or a special forum we had in Window Rock, it's like when you go to GSO in New York, you look up. Everything is up. when you go to Window Rock, Arizona, everything is out. It's just land, and it's beautiful. And they were all kind of, oh, my gosh, there's so much room. I can tell you that after interviewing many of the long-timers at the Arizona, history is somewhat veiled in fog. But it's interesting. We have recently, and I have to tell you that I have been incredibly blessed. When I started in the archives, it was in a storeroom, and we would take out a box at a time, and we would go through it, and we would do the sorting. Arizona now has a sorting committee. We have an interviewing long-timers committee. We have a restoration deacidification. We have a procedures committee and a display committee. It's a big job. You have to leave my legal responsibilities are to maintain the signed copies of the secretary and the treasurer reports. That's the business end. The display end is the fluff. And I love the fluff. We have it divided into categories also. It's archival, historical, memorabilia, and other. That's not in the archives workbook. Arizona's a great place to retire. So people come and bring their stuff from all over. I have all kinds of history on Washington, Chicago. I've got a great bunch of history. A lot of people retired there from Chicago. And what do we do with that? Return that. Now, Steve had mentioned the National Archives Workshop, and I have the pleasure and honor of having been co-chair for that organization. I've been to the last, 10, but we had it one time Indiana. No, where the heck were we? At any rate, I was going through some stuff at our first historian's. He had passed away, and his son had called me and said, "Vicki, do you want to go through this?" I said, "Absolutely." I opened up the very first box. Oh, Butte, Montana. Or Helena, Montana, rather. And the first box I opened up, there was this really wonderful framed picture of Bill W. and a woman. And I thought, oh, great. I turned it over, and she was the delegate from Montana. So I thought, oh, I'm going there next month. So I grabbed the picture. And when I got to the National Archives Workshop, I went up to the host and I asked him if he had any pictures of his past delegates. He said, "No, you know, we've been talking about doing that." And I said, "Well, I have one. I'll be right back." I went up, and he confessed to me later. He said, "Oh, I thought she was going to bring down this grainy black and white thing." And it was a very nice color photograph that was framed. And he cried. "Oh, my God, we don't have anything like this." I said, "Well, now you do. We share. We share information. We share history. We share what we have." I would love, my vision for the committee is I would love to have a place where people come in, they want to look something up, they have access. Digitizing your archives, how do you have that access? It used to be you'd go and microfiche things at the library. I don't think that's really what we want to do. We're a little more, I do have an old typewriter, though, that's manual, but that's just for display. But I would love to have somebody come in and say, "Geez, I'd like to look up my group history," or when did the Navajos start a meeting, or where was this held, and have that access. Have that access at their fingertips. You know, we're getting there. We've moved from this little 5x5 storage room with a garage door type opening to a repository. We just recently acquired 600 square feet of space, and we're going to build this thing. Now, my first National Archives Workshop was in 1996 in Akron, Ohio, when Gail and Faye and Bill had put this thing together, helping archivists who really didn't know what they were doing or needed direction or needed some help, because there really wasn't anything. You know, they told you in art, go help at a museum, take some classes. This just wasn't feasible for a lot of us. You know, I want to be able to do service. I want to do it justice. You know, I'm not into so much of the restoration, deacidification, whatever. I'm into cleaning my documents and making them accessible. You know, when I requested all the history that I could get from the districts and their counties, I did receive some, but the records of the meetings, you know, all important. Unfortunately, because of a resentment, oh no, not one of those, we lost several years' worth of records in the Arizona area because the secretary got ticked off and burned them. So, you know, it's like, oh, they're real. You know, what underlying stuff happened at some of those meetings? I want to know that the chairs got thrown across the room. There was loving discussion, is what it says in the minutes. But, and Joe ended up with a black eye. You know, that kind of stuff, it makes it real. That's the stuff that I like to hear about, you know. We're still gathering, we're still collecting, and now that we have a repository, and know that this is important. More people will donate to your archives if there is a place for it. You know, so much stuff has been lost, been put in people's trunks, or it's in the back of a closet. Another past delegate and I had the opportunity to go through a past delegate's closet when he had passed away, and his wife was really big in Al-Anon. Unfortunately, a collector had gone through before I got there and had taken most of the AA stuff, but in her stuff, there was a letter from Bill W. to past delegates. Now, I am blessed to have served the Arizona area as a panel 50 past delegate. But this letter, and it was 3 pages, and it was so Bill. It was a culmination at the end of it. It was telling this past delegate, no, just go home and, you know, you've done your stuff. You know, be on tap, not on top. But he took him 3 pages to say that. You know, these are gems. These are precious. This is history. You know, I love the fact that we have our archival, our historical, and our memorabilia stuff. And some people love the display, but they don't like having to do the processes. And the processes is, they are very important. Don't get me wrong, but we really, really need to preserve this so that fact does not predominate, or myth does not predominate over fact. I want to thank you guys for this opportunity. This has been incredible, and you're a great audience. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, the first thing I want to do is, I don't think when I got up here and I introduced myself, I don't think I told you my sobriety date, and that's September 10th, 1985. And I just tell you that to let you know that it works. I have a home group, and it's the Singleness of Purpose group. It's a big book study. We meet every Thursday night in Spring Hill, Florida. As I said, I've rotated out of archives in my area, but I'm currently serving, as I told you, I'm a service guy. I currently serve as the DCM for District 13. And what I want to say is that to my friends that showed up here today to kind of support me, thank you so much for coming up. And for my mentors that are here, especially you archivists, you guys know this is a labor of love, isn't it? You know, I'm so grateful to, I was sitting in the meeting last night, in the big meeting, and I remember the one guy who, the one person that was talking about how, talking about being in Alcoholics Anonymous and being up at the podium and thinking that I'm not worthy. You know, and those are the butterflies that get in your stomach, because as I look out and I see some of you that have a lot more experience in archives than I do. And those of you that are my friends, you know how much I love Alcoholics Anonymous and how much I love the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. And hopefully you all got one of those buttons that say I love archives on it, because I do. I love archives. I love Alcoholics Anonymous and I love archives. But there were some, as I said, when I came in and I became archivist, I didn't really know what being an archivist was all about. And thankfully, some of you took the time to explain that to me, and you did that by showing me this workbook and telling me that this is what an archivist does here. And you showed me at the archives workshop. And GSO puts this pamphlet out right here. And I know that when the National Archives Workshop started, it was started because, you know, we're a group of archivists that were given a box or were given a service job, and we had no idea what to do or where to go. And now we do. You know, and I learned that in my very first one through the shared experience from many of you. I learned that from walking into an archives workshop in a state that I didn't even know, right, Bob? And you guys welcomed me. And you were showing me how you were writing your state's history in a book. You know, and I was blessed in 2012 to work on the National Archives Workshop. We had it in Cocoa Beach, Florida. And I learned so much about that. And I never saw so many archives from the state of Florida in one room. And we're all sitting up here and we're talking about what our scope and what archives is in our particular district or area or whatever. And that's our scope. That's what's important to us. And you guys taught me what the important stuff was. So in 2012, we had this workshop in Florida. And I started to think, how many of us are presented with a box and said, go do it? I mean, it's like any other job in AA, right? You know, you're willing to serve, and by the time you figure out what you're supposed to be doing, it's time for you to rotate out, right? And I started to think about, you know, well, how does that relate to my state? How many of my people in my state, in our districts, in archives in our area, cannot afford to go to the National Archives Workshop, cannot get that experience? And that's where it comes in at the local level, of us carrying the message. And a couple of years ago, we were able to put on a workshop in the state of Florida for all of our service entity people, whether they worked in intergroup, district, or at the area level on archives. And thankfully, that was supported by Michelle, by coming down and being in that with us, and Gail. And they taught us so much, you know, and it helped unify archives in the state of Florida, which is important to me because that's where I live. And we're working on trying to have another one. And I hope to, my vision is that hopefully that Florida will be, we've documented our history, but maybe one day we'll be able to put a book together like Virginia has and Georgia has and Washington has. And that's something that will collectively come together through all of us working together in archives in the state of Florida. And so that's part of my collective vision for my state. We have another speaker, and his name is Bob, and he is from New York. And I just can't wait. I just met him just before the meeting today. And I'm sure he's going to have a great message for us. Help me welcome Bob.
Hi, everybody. I'm Bob. I'm an alcoholic. Grateful to be alive and sober today. Truly grateful to be here with you. Wow. My sobriety date is October 2nd, 1995. And my home group is the Penfield Friday Night Group in Penfield, New York, which is a suburb of Rochester. I want to thank Michelle for asking me to present today, and also the AA World Services for doing that. All week, I got here Thursday, and I've been like as nervous as a cat in a room full of rocking chairs, knowing that I'm going to have to get up here and present. And like a good alcoholic, I procrastinated for 5 months and didn't put anything together except between my ears, which is usually the way I do it when I'm asked to share somewhere. But I sort of vacillated between being a good, trusted servant, coming here and wanting to give a report of what the work we've done at not only Area 47 in Central New York, but the intergroup in Rochester. And I talked to a friend of mine yesterday, and he said, that's good. That's good. You know, explain what we've done, you know, what's significant. But also, don't forget your passion for history and the history of our area, Rochester. And so I'm going to try to talk about a little bit of both in the 15 minutes. I am a professional archivist. In 2005, I joined the Archives Intergroup Archives Committee because it changed days. And before that, it conflicted with my home group, and my sponsor told me my home group's a priority. So when it moved to a Wednesday night, I was able to attend, and I always loved history, not only personal history and genealogy, but AA history in particular. You know, it gives me a sense of who I am, history, and I've always been a lover of history. I had a career in the Marine Corps for a long time, but when I got out, I went back and got my degree in history and public history, which is archiving and historical societies. And so when I got a chance to be on this committee and learn about AA history, particularly in Rochester, I was very motivated. And immediately, there was an opening for an archivist because the archivist needed to step down. And I was encouraged to be the intergroup archivist for Rochester. And like some of the panelists said, you know, what I found was a lot of boxes with documents. And boxes with documents aren't archives until you have intellectual control of what they are. Because as a historian, when I learned about archiving and trying to decide what part of the field I wanted to get into, you know, in history, my professor said, archiving is a half between a combination of a historian and the other half a librarian. Because first you have to appraise the documents for their historical value. Then you need to organize them so you can make sense and have intellectual control of them. And so researchers can find what they're looking for in their research. That made sense to me. And I've always been good at organizing. So when we took over, we had a lot of... there had been an archives committee for about 10 years. And there had been a lot of good work done. But it wasn't really organized in the sense from an archivist point of view. And so that's what we immediately started to do. The archives workbook was our guide. We set up a collection policy, a mission statement, and we made up the forms of deed of gift, the transfer of temporary custody, right out of the book, right out of the archives book. We just put our name and our address and all that stuff, and we tried to use that as a guide. And we moved it to where I worked as a medical archivist. And we set it up, this program, so the people that after we rotated off, they would have some guidance of how to carry forward, how to organize it, but also how to keep what they found for the future generations. We set up, like I said, the manuals, the forms, but we also started creating exhibits of the history that we found. And now, later I'm going to talk a little bit about how AA started in Rochester and why it's significant to AA as a whole, but what we started to do is try to organize what we had. We would have Saturday work parties, where the committee would get together, and we'd buy donuts and coffee, and we'd just go through boxes. And initially I set up a record listing of the different types of records, financial, meeting minutes, etc., the committees for the intergroup, to try to understand what we needed to keep and what we needed to throw away, because whatever we kept, the intergroup's going to have to pay for storage for that for years to come. And that guided us, you know, that appraising what the document was about and what it said about Rochester history, AA history, rather than just keeping it everything, because it's so easy to do that. And as a historian, I immediately started doing research. And we had had a little history booklet that said that our AA in Rochester started by a man named G. Kirby Collier. He was a psychiatrist. And so I started learning about how it all started and who this person was. And he heard about AA, and he was a psychiatrist, had four patients. And he went down to New York and met Bill W. And he wanted to hear about what AA was about. And it all started from there. I'm going to talk about a little bit what we did here. Over the next few years, the area started organizing their archives, and I was asked, our committee was asked to help them. So we went down and we surveyed it. It was in someone's shed in their back lot. And through the help of other members of the two archives committees, the area and Rochester, we were able to, you know, sort it out and decide what we really needed to keep to get an accurate record of what transcribed and what we needed to throw away. I gave some recommendations for preservation of these documents and materials they needed to purchase, you know, document boxes, acid-free folders, etc. And slowly that began to grow. They appointed an archivist for the area, Neil B., and he's done a wonderful job of that. And over the last 5 years, what they've done, Central New York Archives Committee, they digitized all their meeting minutes going back to the 50s, and they put them into a PDF file so they could be searchable. And that's a wonderful resource. Matter of fact, as I was driving up here 3 days ago, I got a research request from a member of our area. He's like the recorder, the area recorder. He wanted to know about the words inclusive and exclusive in motions in the last 15 years. And through email, I was able to ask Neil to search it, and he found over the last 15 years, every time in all the motions and the minutes, where the word inclusion and exclusive came up. And it was just wonderful to see this research request electronically come through us, and it was dealt with, and the individual had his information for the next area assembly. And it was just wonderful, the work they've done. I was appointed the Rochester Intergroup Archivist in March of 2006, and a part of that process was setting up term limits, because there was none, along with the other responsibilities of members and guidance of how the committee should grow and work. And I stepped off. I rotated out of the committee eventually last January after 9 years, and I was glad to do it because I believe it's a privilege to serve Alcoholics Anonymous. And my opinion that, you know, it would be wrong for me to keep a position that someone else could enjoy and grow and benefit from. So I rotated out. We were able to elect a new archivist, Tom S., and he's moving forward. And it's a wonderful to sit back and see the growth and know that it's going to be fine. As we all rotate off into other service positions, it's going to continue to grow. One of the things that's sort of interesting is, like I said, this G. Kirby Collier person kept coming up because I didn't really know that much about him, and there was a lot of speculation of how AA started. I was doing research online, and I looked up, I did a Google search, and I found the obit of his daughter, and she was 94 when she died, but because he died in 1953, and I was able to contact, through that obit, her relatives, her children in Connecticut. Because I wanted to learn about this Kirby Collier, what happened to him. I knew, to give you a little background, why it's significant is because he had an influence on AA as a whole that I'm going to talk about. It's not just about Rochester history, but he worked at an epilepsy colony from like 1900 till 1930. And he was one of the individuals that discovered that epilepsy was not a mental illness, that it was a physical illness that could be cured through surgery. And he was one of the three people who discovered this about 1910. And so he was world-renowned for his work in epilepsy. And eventually he got out of that and went into private practice as a neurologist and a psychiatrist. And that's when he started working with alcoholics. We found out, Michelle's predecessor, Amy, I emailed her and I wanted information about the first communications with AAs in Rochester, you know, in Western New York. And so she sent me the communications with the first people who wrote the foundation, GSO, which became GSO, about meetings and also about Bill's or Kirby Collier's correspondence with Bill. And like I said earlier, he was interested in this Alcoholics Anonymous because he'd been working with AAs and he really didn't have no, you know, cure for him. He knew that there was something else. And he went down, he met Bill, and I have some quotes that I want to talk about to emphasize how instrumental or what Bill and Kirby Collier's relationship happened. He wrote a letter to Bill and asking information. They went down there, and then Bill wrote back to him. And this is from Collier's first visit. Bill says, "As though it was yesterday, I can remember how excited we were all when you turned up at the old 24th Street Club, and how doubly joyful we became when you seemed to set your stamp of approval on what you saw and felt there in the time AA was very young." Dr. Collier believed in AA. And this is the time when we all know from the first edition, Dr. Silkworth didn't put his name in the book, in Doctor's opinion, because he was concerned about his welfare and his career. And doctors did not like alcoholics, because we all know alcoholics lie and they don't pay their bills. But Kirby Collier, he was at the end of his career, because he got his medical degree in 1900. So he was open to that. And he stood up and he came back, and he talks about it in the back of the big book under the Medical View of Alcoholics Anonymous. He talks about how he gave his three AA members the book, some pamphlets, and said, "You do it yourself. I mean, it's best that you run this yourself." And they set up AA in a person's apartment. 6 weeks later, they rented a room in the Seneca Hotel in Rochester, New York, and that became the Seneca Group. And as of now, the Seneca Group is 42, so it's 63 years old, 73 years old. 1942, and it still meets once a week. Rochester has a very prestigious, active AA. We have 385 groups. We have 400 meetings a week, 480 meetings a week. And it all started from that first meeting with Bill and Dr. Collier. One of the things that we did also in the Rochester Intergroup Archives, and we've moved on to the area, not moved on, but we're doing some new projects with the area, is I solicited many places for their first edition and second edition big books, because we didn't have any. And going through World Catalog, or it's called World Cat Online, I was able to find these books in these obscure libraries close to us. And our committee, we wrote them a letter asking them to donate it to our archives so we could preserve it. And I explained how important it was to us, you know, and that we replaced the book with a new fourth edition, because if anybody coming going to check a book out, that would be more beneficial to them to have a book that's up to date of the kind of culture we have today. Over the next year and a half, we have a first edition, first printing that was in the University of Rochester, three blocks from where we were, and it was there since March of 1940. So 11 months after being published, and it sat on the shelf for all those years, and they donated it to us. We have all the checkout, you know, they remember the old stamps of the dates, and they donated to us. We got one from the University of Maryland. We got one from the Chautauqua Institute. We have many, you know, first editions from the different printings, but this first printing, first edition, is a treasure, and it's in perfect shape, no markings and stuff like that. That's another project that we worked on there. We also we had a history booklet of Rochester AA that was made up in 1990 by some of the AAs on that committee at that time, but it needed updating. So one of the things we did is we did exactly that. We went through our research that we had done, and we updated it and included some nice photographs, and we made a new copy that we print up and we give out at AA anniversaries, you know, when they ask for the traveling archives. It's one of the things that we worked on. We also have an intergroup archives pamphlet that talks about the committee, talks about the work we've done. In 2007, we had an archives roadshow. Antique Roadshow, we had one like an archives roadshow where we had not a fundraiser, but we had a benefit where you bring a dish and people brought their little AA treasures that their sponsor gave them. It was very, very well received. We've also did some bookmarks that help highlight the work that we do and trying to invite other people to join our committees and help us save this important history. One of them is, this is for the area where we have a bookmark that says, "Don't throw it out." You know, donate it to the archives, basically. And it talks about what we collect, what we don't collect, you know, where to meet, where we meet, how to get involved if you're interested. And we hand these out at our area assemblies and at meetings throughout the area. One of the things that we thought was good, we made up some bookmarks. And they're just just basically says, you know, Rochester A's Heritage, don't throw it out, donate it to the archives, because a lot of people find things that their loved ones, after they've passed away, have kept for years, and it's a way to collect, you know, the significant history of the people in the area. And we made one up that has the 12-step principles with, you know, the archives, and one with all the key figures from Rochester A history. Rochester's lucky that we have three major individuals who were non-alcoholics who were significant in AA history. One was Nell Wing. We all know Nell Wing was Bill's personal secretary for many years, and she became the first AA archivist. She was born in one of our suburbs, you know, and she was raised there. And so, and of course, her impact is in AA is well known. Dr. John L. Norris, some of you might know him. He was the medical director of Eastman Kodak. Eastman Kodak used to be big in Rochester. Now it's barely hanging on. But Dr. Norris, one of the janitorial men in Eastman Kodak, was in AA and introduced him to AA. And, of course, Dr. Norris was big in industrialization of treatment for alcohol, treatment for alcoholics in industry. And then eventually he became, he was the chairman of the general trustees of AA for 25 years. And he did a lot for helping AA grow in Rochester, but also helping to promote the disease concept of AA. And that's where Dr. Kirby Collier really did a lot of his contribution. Dr. Kirby Collier, after the initial meeting with Bill, because of his well-known reputation in the medical community and his willingness to stick his neck out there, if you will, he went to the New York State Medical Society and convinced them to hear Bill in 1944. And Bill went before the New York Medical Society and talked about what Alcoholics Anonymous was, what it wasn't, and it was well received. And a lot of these skeptical physicians who, like I said, didn't really want to treat alcoholics for a lot of reasons, sort of gave AA a second look. And it had a lot to do with Bill, because Bill was an articulate speaker and a very, very eloquent person. But also it had a lot to do with the reputation of not only Kirby Collier, but of course Harry Tybout and Dr. Bauer and Kennedy, Dr. Kennedy. These were significant psychiatrists in the early AA history. But Dr. Collier was significant in getting them up to hear Bill for the first time. And then 4 years later, when the American Psychiatric Association was meeting in Montreal, I believe, 1949, Dr. Collier was the vice president of the association and got them to allow Bill to address their conference, the American Psychiatric Association. And Bill talks about it here. Pardon me? Okay, someone else. Yep. 1 minute? Wow, 1 minute. I thought I'd be last so I could, like, drag a little bit. Huh? Take two. Okay. This is what Bill said when hearing that Dr. Collier died, or he heard his first of his illness. He says, "This word of your difficulty set me thinking about you with great gratitude. As though it were yesterday, I can remember how well excited you were when we turned out to the old 24th Street Club. I remember what you said to us much later before the Medical Society of both New York State and reread your words. I remember what your influences upon your brother psychiatrists has meant to us and the benign consequence that have flowed through that paper out of Montreal. Please care..." Well, no. The last one I want to talk about is that Kirby Collier, you know, he's not really well known, but if you look in the back of the big book, he was one of the three physicians, along with Harry Tybout, that had a big impact in promoting this disease concept. And now today, you know, we all know about it. Late 40s is when the American Medical Association changed their ruling on that. But it had a lot to do with small communities around the country, and Rochester, one of them. And I want to thank the committee for asking me to share. And I have a whole bunch of our ephemera booklets that I'm going to take to the Northeast Regional Hospitality Room and pass them out there. Thank you very much. Thank you.